So Daniela, we met in a very special way. And I have a very good friend who Andrew Imperata, who is a very special person, and we both share a friendship with him. And his introduction for me years ago was into the world of disabilities. And while I have family members and friends and people in the company that I've known in different situations that might be in that, encompassed in that, really looking at it through the lens of a woman and from the feminine perspective was really different for me. And so he asked me to do a fashion show in Washington, and I did. And I never forgot the impact of these personalities of joyous, funny, positive, everything you want for yourself when you wake up in the morning, everything you think, I need to be that person. And I never forgot it until I met with you guys. I had sort of the memory of it, but the refresher hit me hard, and you had this fashion disability scenario going, and I came in a little later. Everybody was sitting, and I wasn't aware of disability. It didn't I was, yeah, okay, that's it, but I don't know who these people are or what's going on. I saw a couple of people that I knew, but I didn't really register. All I registered was these are the most beautiful girls. They're obviously into fashion because they're talking to me about fashion. And until the dialogue started, until you had everybody around the table start talking about their stories. And so tell us first about how you put that evening together and what happened.
Yeah, I think, well, that evening, Andy was visiting, and I wanted to curate this group of women that he'd probably never met before. Because I think when we talk about social movements and disability, we often think of the shoulders in which we're standing on with the people that have been in the past that have set the stage for a new human rights movement, which I personally believe is the disability rights movement. But there are so many younger women that are doing this work, specifically in fashion, specifically in curating their own kind of sense of a human experience that Andy needed to meet. And so I curated this kind of eclectic group of women leading kind of their own spaces that I wanted to be at the table. And I wanted to have them share stories because I think what often happens is these intimate and very personal details of disability and the human experience aren't often shared, specifically not shared for a wider audience. And so this was a chance to collect, 20 plus women who are specifically leading in this space on the East Coast, but recognizing that they're extend far beyond what's happening just here in New York City. So it was a really lovely evening to also just hear very personal stories and how we can all connect with one another. We now have this WhatsApp chat of women we keep adding with disabilities to this group chat so that we can also expand our network. I think as women, we're often elbowing each other for the same space and competing. And that certainly happens within the disability rights movement as well. It's the scarcity model. Everybody's fighting after the same piece of pie, the same kind of attention. And I really want to stop that. We got to quit that and work towards something together.
So, I think this is a good place to just talk about you and what you're doing, so that it gives us the, sort of the head, the focus of this, and then what you're working on. So my impression of you was, oh, so this is her house, this is her apartment, which I was very familiar with because I used to live in the building, and a friend of mine either lived next door to you or there in like 1980. So I was feeling like, oh my God, like I feel like he's in the room. And then you really captured my attention throughout the evening, not because you were like trying to be center stage or steal the show. You just had a sense of calm intention, and it dominated silently, and it gave everybody a comfortable place to tell their stories, a safe place, which is your house, your apartment, your beautiful place. And I was so impressed with you. I could not help thinking, I think this woman someday has to run for president right now. If she could be, I don't know, governor, something, we could change the world. And you're so young and so capable that whatever you do going forward, we will all benefit from. But I think if you can kind of just give us a little background of how you got here from the beginning of interest to where we are, next step.
Yeah, the way I went into kind of this space started out really young. My mom's first generation American. She's Italian American, grew up in New York City, and has had quite a bit of, a difficult family experience where she was the youngest, born much later, and most of her family had passed by the time I was born, except for her sister Nina, who came to live with us when I was about 12 years old. She'd moved from the East Coast to come to California, where I grew up. And Nina was schizophrenic, had been diagnosed with schizophrenia at the age of 16, and now was in kind of her later 60s. And so I think it wasn't until I was about 16 and recognized, oh, this is a part of our human experience. Disability is a part of everybody's family, but we shelter that experience, mm-hmm. and we don't talk about it. And I think now as an adult, I recognize Nina was completely socially isolated, didn't have these enormous opportunities that everybody else did. And that's partially because of the social barriers, because of the economic barriers, and mostly because we don't understand what mental illness looks like, mm-hmm. kind of within a family nucleus as well. And so there was one day where my mom and I were driving Nina. We would kind of do a ritual of going out and grabbing a coffee and coming back. And that was her kind of day out, day in, day out. And I think when I reflected on what that experience was like for my mom, really having, I'm the youngest of, I have two other sisters, but really having almost another child where this was a part of her work life. And so Nina had seen a man on the street and looked at my mom and said, the man was, walking back and forth and speaking to himself. She said to my mom, "If it weren't for you, that's where I would be." And so I remember that when I was 14 years old, and have taken that with me, more than a decade later. Started learning sign language in high school. They teach it in California public schools. Went on and studied at Gallaudet, took sign language classes at Gallaudet, which is the all-deaf university, the first in the United States.
Where is that?
It's in D.C. And studied in D.C. and American. Really wanted to focus on disability policy in business. So how can we really shape a better society through employment? I think if Nina was incredibly smart, knew horoscopes backwards and forwards, and you know, played games and crocheted, and there were so many opportunities where she could have benefited from being in a workforce. She was incredibly creative, that if we could open more doors to those possibilities, I think we would have, she would have thrived. And, you know, reflecting on that now, I think about how I've tried to build my career towards that. And I'm really an independent consultant on a number of projects now in New York City. I, again, lived through DC, did all the policy work, and had really tried to formulate a base, but needed a bigger city. DC is a little small for me. Mm-hmm. And came to New York, and I'm working with the International Finance Corporation to ensure disability becomes a part of the way in which we invest in the Global South. So how are we ensuring economic inclusion for people with disabilities across the globe, not just in higher income countries? And working with a large fashion sports brand to help them curate a really adaptive and progressive shoe so that people with disabilities also reflect themselves within their brand. And then also I'm working on a really important piece of legislation called the CVTA. It's the Communications, Video, and Technology Act, to build on ensuring that the future of technology and technology as it exists today is actually accessible for people with disabilities. So to make that story round and whole, I've become more and more deeply connected with disability through my mom, who had a stroke this last summer. And she's just coming into her disability identity and recognizing, oh, I walk with a limp now. And now my speech sometimes gets slurred because I'm really tired. And so how can we make people feel comfortable with that identity? How can we make people feel like it is not a taboo? It is not a trope. It is not a negative stereotype, but it's a part of an everyday experience.
You know, as you were talking about that in the family setting, mm-hmm. I think about it in, you know, the work family. Mm-hmm. And there's someone here who's been working with me for 50 years. We have a lot of family here. Mm-hmm. And when she was about 20, she was with her husband driving, and they got a flat tire. He opened the door, hit by a car, and has been challenged with a disability and adapting and learning through the years to be a vital part of father and husband. And so their lives really took a turn in a different direction. They have a huge family circle, and so you have people and families who have that within their family circle. And then throughout the years, there are people that come and go that have reasons to kind of make an adjustment in their lives, do things. And the closer the family circle is, whether it's home or like your mother did for her sister or here, we really just, because you care about each other, you automatically have a sense of, well, what does that mean? How much time do you need off? Okay, we get this covered. And I think it's humanity, right? First, it's like sense of humanity and responsibility. And it doesn't change the productivity, which is interesting. I find that whether it's a disability or moms that have three kids or that need to have days that they work from home or any of those sort of things that maybe need time or change, in the end, they are the most productive people in the company. The moms with the kids, the whole thing, are the most productive in the company. People who have special things that they have to take care of. There was somebody working late on Friday, and I said, isn't it time for you to be going home? And she said, no. Remember, I always take Fridays for my appointments, and that's her special thing that she does. And it's like, I don't have to tell her. Mm-hmm. I don't have to say, well, shouldn't you be making up for that? Why would I even have to say it? I'm telling her to go home because mm-hmm. she's productive. So I think that there's this very personal side, the way you talked about your mother and her relationship, and you saw that. It's just the way you do it. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's family. It's just the way you do it. Work family is just the way you do it. But I think when anything is different, whether it's a different skin color or different, anything is different, we start to have all of these things kind of that, what's different? Why is it different? Not the same as I am or whatever. But the more intimately you're involved, mm-hmm. the less of that sort of static hits you. So what do you think people need to know straight out for people who maybe are not in one of these family situations, whether it's home or work family? What is it they need to know so that they're less sort of letting static come into their heads before they understand a person and what that person is about?
I think it comes down to judgment, right? And that's something everybody can work on. I don't care who you are.
Right.
You know, everybody has their own inherent bias that they bring to the table. But I think the most important thing to recognize is, one, disability is not monolithic. So just because my mom had a stroke and Nina was schizophrenic, those are two very different disabilities. Yeah. And so when we talk about things like disability versus gender can be binary or, you know, split in three or four different ways. But disability expands in a lot of different ways, and it is a very broad brushstroke, right? So somebody who might be neurodiverse has a different need than somebody who might be deaf. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing that there are intrinsic differences and cultural differences as well is really important lens to the work. I think the other really important aspect of this, especially when we're talking about a city like New York, is that accessibility or flexibility, specifically in a workplace like yours, benefits everybody.
Yeah.
You don't need to have a disability. You might have three kids. You may be walking down the street with a stroller and, the little curved divoted bump on the sidewalk really helps. I don't have to go out and take the stroller up. So I think also in that context of having an aging population, right? We're going to have, by 2030, 60% of the population is going to be over the age of 60. So how are we outfitting the city, public spaces, education systems, technology to ensure it benefits everybody, using that lens of disability inclusion, using that lens and broadening it a bit so that what we're building for the future is actually sustainable for the future. Yeah. It's not just something we'll have to go back and retrofit.
Yeah, definitely. I one of the categories that I have my podcast in, I have fashion and music and comedy, and then obviously longevity, lifestyle, and AI. And in under that, longevity is just all about lifestyle, how we live, what we do. And at 78, obviously, I'm fitting into that group. And the key message for that group is healthy lifestyle, workout, do exercise, eat well, focus on how to stay relevant by working and staying active so that everything, you don't lose it if you don't use it, kind of thing. And you're right. I think the population. We need to inspire that population to stay active so that we don't have the burden of how to manage this big, big group coming into a part of our lives that really we're not dealing with, or we don't really know how to deal with properly. One of the things about the evening, and I'm sure you focused it this way, was the storytelling. And the way, and again, this is when you really, Martin Luther King has an incredible quote that really says, when you fear someone, it's because you don't know them. Mm-hmm. That's my shorthand version of it. But I have that quote right at the entrance of my mm-hmm. apartment, because to me, knowing somebody's story, it brings you intimately into their world. And the more you know, the more you connect. And so these stories and these people that you've made comfortable in your environment really just were I can't articulate, isn't even the right word. They were articulating a story with the sincerity and the a way that I couldn't leave. Yeah. I'm go to bed at 8:30. I don't think I maybe got home at 12:30, and I could not leave. I fell in love with every single one of them, and they just were extraordinarily beautiful at the same time, and you just were so captivated. How did you decide to put all of that together?
I think if I had a superpower, it would be about connecting people. That is something I love to do.
Well, you do it well.
Thank you. And it's curating, again, special moments like this where people feel safe to share. And if you can't, and it's partially the reason why I did this in my apartment. I feel like everybody watching is going to think I have this grandiose apartment. It's just one long apartment. So we essentially set up this table where everybody had a seat at the table, which is something else we don't talk about. Mm-hmm. How do we get more women, but specifically women with disabilities, to sit down, share their stories with the people that actually can listen, hear, and make movement and action on it?
Yeah.
And so I think what I wanted to do for that evening was bring the stories of women that aren't often heard outside of their own vacuums and outside of their own communities to a table where there was an opportunity to meet other women like them and meet other women who had shared experiences or had more to offer to expand their network and understand and expand their frame of thinking. And I hope that we can continue to do that, because that is something where, again, I'm going to make a generalization, but women are often clawing at the same thing and you know, throwing elbows to get to the same place. So how can we curate this community of trust, but also this community of belonging? And I know that the title of this is Invincible Threads. I think of disability or inclusion as that invisible thread through the way in which we go about the world. And if you recognize that on the street and you're walking down the street in New York City today, you'll notice or recognize 20 different people who have a disability and 20 that don't, because they're not often always seen as a disability, or you don't actually, you know, recognize it within somebody's body. And so I think that was the point of this kind of gathering, was to get more women at the table to share stories, but also resonate with one another and build trust, build community, but also recognize, like you had mentioned, when you sit down at the table, the disability isn't the first thing you see.
No. I think another characteristic that was universal and extremely powerful to me was they all had some of what you offer, which is that networking intention. They networked. They were aggressive in the most beautiful way. They weren't sitting back, and there was no victim, none of this, nothing about entitlement, nothing about all of the things that we kind of shudder at in where we may be going as a society. They have the ideal of, I'm going to get that. I'm going to reach out to that. I'm going to find a way to do it. And it's so inspiring and exciting because to me, that's the person I want to hire. And I'm trying more and more to find that kind of person. And one of the things I thought of was like, well, how do you find, like, do I say I specifically want somebody who has a disability because they're just on it and they're inspired and they look at life in a way that we wish everybody did? So what's the, how can that work? I mean, they were all some way interested or involved in fashion, which was fantastic. But then I thought, I have so many positions to fill. I don't know, like, I don't know what the protocol is. Like, what is the, what do you do? So what's on the, what's on the agenda for this?
So a couple of things. It's October, which means it's National Disability Employment Awareness Month, NADEEM, which was declared a really important month back in the 60s. And that's what laid essentially the groundwork for the Rehabilitation Act, which came a decade later, which laid groundwork for the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which then laid the groundwork for what happened in 2006, which was the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. The United States has not ratified that convention. We don't see it as a convention, mostly because we have the ADA, but recognizing that employment for people with disabilities in the United States in particular is really low. Far fewer for people who are deaf or blind. Employment is a really big obstacle to social inclusion, to economic benefits, to upward mobility. So that's why kind of that poverty cycle with disability and with employment is intrinsically linked. So I'm very excited to hear that you're looking to hire more disabled people because of that, but also because of NADEEM's, again, National Disability Awareness Month's kind of view of disability this month in October is that disability drives innovation. And so that is the theme this month and this year, but it is absolutely true. I think when you design for disability, let's say specifically within fashion, you design for everybody. You design because it makes sense for all different kinds of groups and people. I think there's plenty of resources I'm happy to share. One that comes to mind is, I think it's Accessibly. It is a platform which seeks out disabled job seekers and looks to hire them at companies across across the United States. There's something I've started called Talent Tuesday, where I have so many colleagues and friends who have a disability who are finding it extremely difficult to find work. And I, again, want to use that network and that platform that I have to be able to share their experiences.
Well, and we'll share that. And yeah, I would like to go through that experience with you so we could talk about that too and how I figure out a way to do. The other thing is I found them very entrepreneurial. I mean, I had a feeling that they would all tell me, no, we're not looking for a job, and I'm an entrepreneur, and this is what I do, and you can buy something from me, right? I thought that this group, I don't know, they're running their own show, right? I mean, that was clear. So, and of course, that's why I want to hire any of them, because if you think like an entrepreneur, no matter what, where you are in life, you're the best. You'll be the best employee, you'll be the best manager, you'll be the best VP, you'll be the best person running the company and then taking it over, obviously. So that attitude was really So that was powerful. That was really a powerful kind of exciting look at young women. Mm-hmm. For me, as a woman, looking at women with that energy, that's why I was saying I was just taken by the positive attitude, the entrepreneurial spirit, the intention. And by the way, this is my story, which just my head was exploding. It was like, this is everything I dream to find. This is what my search is. What I loved was the stories about how fashion was so meaningful to them. And each story was really saying, I used fashion so that people viewed me through that lens, like my hair, my makeup, each of them, just hair, makeup, but not like gorgeous, beautiful, tasteful, elegant. The way they dressed, I was happy to see some of my clothes there. It was a nice touch. I thought that was very sweet. But they put themselves together so beautifully. And I know you and I had a conversation about this, and I understand personally about their need to use fashion for their first impression, because growing up, I grew up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood where everybody had blonde hair, red hair, cutesy little noses. And I just felt like such an ugly duckling. My nose was bigger than my face. I was just so different that my definition of beauty was distorted. I didn't fit into that pretty. And I thought, I saw that the way I wore my clothes, they would copy it. So I said, I'm working this one. And so I made clothes my expression. So when they said that, I was like, that's what I did too. I totally get it. I see what they're doing with fashion. And so how did that come about? How did the fashion and how did that work together?
Yeah, I think fashion is still an industry that is yet to be disrupted for people with disabilities, right? Although I will say your clothes are highly adaptive. When I went and tried on a couple of different pieces, there's just Velcro. It's not buttons that make it really difficult. I think about my mom, who would have a really hard time with those buttons. Snaps, right? These are things that are, we call them modalities, or things that can be smallly or not necessarily significantly adapted so that everybody benefits. Some of the women there actually just recently were a part of a Victoria's Secret campaign for undergarments that are actually adaptive.
Awesome.
You can walk in a Victoria's Secret store now and see them on the wall. That is a really big push towards a movement that has been completely disregarded, right? And again, as I talk about disability, I think and I hope, and I'm, you know, it's the hill I'll die on, which is that disability is that next movement. It is similar to how women, you know, really fought for those rights at the table. The fashion industry is not yet an industry that's been disrupted or considered when we talk about disability inclusion. So I think that was the premise of that conversation in that group, because these are women that are breaking those barriers and breaking those stereotypes and breaking down those conversations. And without them at their various seats at the table, and then also collectively at my table in my long dining room, we would not understand what those movements look like and where those struggles or challenges are to better come together and connect on how can we help, what can we do. And so I think that community still is missing. We need to cultivate a community where more and more people are welcome and more people are sharing stories, challenges, and opportunities so that we can better augment, we can better support, and stop throwing elbows to get in the way of each other.
I think the more people in the fashion industry that understand And we are all about pretty, right? It's what we want to show and do. And the reason I got captured, it was like you couldn't have signed me up faster just being in that room. I mean, that's how we sell clothes. That's how we sell everything. You know, it's part of what the fashion industry is about. And pretty is a big description, right? Yeah. You know, people with big noses are pretty now too, and shapes and sizes. So, but it wasn't that they are pretty. It's that they knew how to style themselves. They knew, they got they had their individual thing going. And so that's what I mean about fashion. Like, they took me in. They without trying, I was just captivated by them. So anything they said was so comfortable to me. And I know that the fashion industry is a very compassionate industry. It's a very generous industry. The people are very loving, and we work really hard, and there's a real care factor. And I think the more the industry has the experience that I had, and I'm sure some have, the industry will find a way, because they spoke our language, right? They spoke to us in a way that said, we get you, now you get us. Without, and they never had to tell me to get them. They won me over. And so I think one of the things we can do together is have these conversations in a more an intimate setting, which we will do. I think we agreed to May 2nd to creating an intimate setting, sort of bring that to the next conversation with all the girls and anybody else you want to invite, and invite people to have the experience that I had. And I think the more people who have that experience will come up with ideas and opportunities, because selfishly it will benefit us, right? It totally will benefit us. We're not doing anybody a favor. We're all going to benefit from that. So tell me what you think, what are some of the other things that can be done for awareness?
Yeah, I think to your point on kind of staying with that thread of fashion, we've got to still do some of that awareness and still build some of that community and understanding of disabled people also are sexy. They are, you know, unique, and we're kind of boxed in this medical model of how we view disability. Oh, it's after you have a car crash. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's after you have this major accident. No, it is a lifelong experience, right? And so it might be now, but it might be 30 years from now. Mm-hmm. So it is something that we have to view as not just boxed in its own stereotype, but how it expands and continues throughout a lifetime. Understanding that disabled people buy things too, right? So you know, if you're in the marketing industry or in the fashion industry, how are you promoting your products so that what's reflected in a campaign is also reflected of your consumers? Looking to, you know, major models on a runway who can also be included as part of that fiber or part of that thread of the story that you're telling. I think, you know, we saw this in Paris and London Fashion Week, and also in New York Fashion Week, where there were, for the first time, disabled models on the runway. That shouldn't be for the first time. We're in 2023, almost 2024. It's taken enough time to get here. How can we accelerate it? We're already behind. I think those are certainly some of the ways in which we can continue to gain exposure for this movement, but also continue to build that community. And also brands benefit greatly when they put a disabled person, one as a spokesperson, but two as kind of the lightning rod within the community. Mm-hmm. And so looking at kind of the adaptive fashion as certainly a way forward, it's a $400 billion industry, you know, projected over the next couple of years. I think it's over the next 5 years, because again, you have an aging population, you have mothers that will benefit, you have mm-hmm. families that benefit. It's built for everyone. So as we look to kind of advance the conversation there, I think there's so much that can happen both in the brand marketing space, but uh-huh. also in the product itself.
Yeah.
The one thing I'll say as a takeaway is design with, not for. So if mm-hmm. you're going to design an adaptive fashion or apparel, make sure you have people with disabilities testing those products, mm-hmm. understanding those products, not pushing something out in the market right. and saying, hope this works. And again, make sure that the community that you're reflecting in your stories, in your campaigns, on the runway, actually have that lived experience with a disability. Mm-hmm. Have them share their stories. Don't share them for them.
Yeah. The also at your house, you had people who were making products mm-hmm. and there was this really terrific girl, an FIT student who, for a relative, created products mm-hmm. that, and she said, I wanted to be a designer. That was my intention. But then I saw that I could really help a relative, mm-hmm. a cousin, I believe it was, have a life change because of something I could design. Mm-hmm. And then, so now she's in it to win it mm-hmm. for sure. And hopefully she'll be invited too with other people who are developing mm-hmm. products that we could talk about and do some show and tell.
Yeah.
I think that to me is, it's sort of like my cousin. I have a cousin in Australia who started years ago to make reusable mm-hmm. diapers, and the name of the company is Me Nappy, you know, the Australian version. And it was a struggle for her because now reuse a diaper, mm-hmm. oh my God, how gross. And she would say, I can't imagine how difficult this is. Yeah. And she was in fashion before. Mm-hmm. And then it started to pick up. And then the elderly, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, this is working for them too. She said, I have some momentum here. Not only have people understand recycling, sustainability, and all of that. And then finally, it opened to disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that, so now she's expanded it in the disability world mm. where she really has been sort of a pioneer in mm. like, let's look at things in a different way, and originally was doing design and fashion, and her business, now her son and her family mm. have kind of expanded it. And it's incredible that you can be an entrepreneur with a unique idea mm-hmm. and see how it works for everyone and functions. And so, like you said, it's not just thinking of it in one mm-hmm. way, that it sort of, it expands out. And this girl was also talking about how it just sort of got legs and kept going. And I think the universe helps people. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing something, I think the universe takes you, either stops you, don't go in that direction, or yep, keep going. Mm-hmm. We're going to give you a couple of tweaks along the way. So it helps. So I think that, talk about innovation. There are areas for innovation. And after we had the conversation, you were saying the Velcro and all of that. And I thought, oh my God, I have an idea. You know, it started like all of a sudden you think, wow, I didn't realize that the simplicity of a design in the multiple purpose, multiple use, mm-hmm. easy care, all of that, I love as a brand. So I have to learn more, though. You're right. I can't just in my bubble think. I need to have somebody who's directing me and giving me advice, which maybe we can do when we have our get together. So I keep talking about this get together. Yes. So what we've decided is that we want to, this is your evening, you will orchestrate the evening, but we want to recreate some of that energy and the storytelling and add in some other things. I think some lessons on what makes a sustainable garment that in this adaptive kind of interpretation, what people can learn about in hiring. I think especially after people meet these incredible women, they will understand why I'm saying that. So you will be putting together an evening, and we will film it and make it available for people to, in your network and through our network too, in learning more about sustainability in adaptive fashion and how to benefit from the opportunity that you are bringing awareness to.
Yeah, I think it's a really important moment. One, because May is another really big tent holiday within the community, but it is a moment where I think women have this opportunity to lead at the table, and specifically entrepreneurs. I think disabled entrepreneurs, believe this is the correct statistic, but it's less than 1% of disabled entrepreneurs are actually invested in. So when it comes to VCs, when it comes to looking just at venture capital, that is certainly a space that needs to be disrupted and also brought along in this conversation. And then you add women or gender to that mix and that binary, and it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and this kind of social circle of exclusion becomes more present. And so I'm hoping that we'll use May 2nd as an opportunity for one, women to network, two, to learn so that the fashion industry can also learn about the benefits of including disabled people as part of your workforce, but also externally, as part of campaigns or brand management or awareness, but then ultimately learning about adaptive fashion and what that means for everyone, the elderly, people with disabilities, right, families, people on the go, right? I love wearing a Norma Kamali night to day kind of outfit. But I think there's so much opportunity to unpack within this one evening, but want to open that circle to people within this community, specifically in New York, who have that opportunity to take those lessons and then go and make them actionable. And so certainly it's about bringing younger voices to the conversation, but ultimately leaning on the leaders of today, you yourself, and as well as a few others within the New York community who can go and say, yeah, we do need to employ and empower more disabled people as part of our workforce. Yes, we do need to ensure that the brands that we're promoting and the, you know, New York Fashion Weeks of tomorrow are actually sustainable, accessible, and inclusive. So that is the thread that I would like to ensure we take along with us in the journey.
Yeah. I think the gender, the women in this, I think that's an important part of it. Every time you say that, I think, oh my God, yes. Being a woman in business for 56 years, I have my list of challenges that I've had along the way. I don't have somebody supporting me or funding my business or helping me be an entrepreneur. I've done it basically on my own. And I think how challenging that had been and how many nights I cried myself to sleep thinking that I'd be out of business the next day. And then you add layers of challenges to that. And it's really difficult. And I think women are up to the challenge. I think we're stronger than is believed. Mm. There's nothing weak about women. Mm. Just plain out, there is nothing weak about women. It's like you mentioned, not having the support of other women. Mm. That is sort of the question. Mm. Like, why not? We have to help each other. Because the more success there is in each of these areas, the more inspiration that is, and also the more we then can help. When people are successful, mm-hmm. they're more likely to help.
Right.
And when you're competing, it's harder, yep. right? So I think there's another aspect of this that we could bring in some groups, women's groups mm-hmm. as well. But I just started by saying my first experience with disabilities in fashion was just so uplifting because of the personalities and the humor. Mm. I love humor. I love it. And I remembered that, whoa, these people are funny. I mean, what a group. They were funny. And then that experience at your house was just, it's uplifted me during a time like this mm. when there isn't very much mm. that you can hang on to without feeling like it's very fragile. Mm. They really made me feel, you know what? Things can be all right. We'll figure this out. I'm gonna use that energy that mm. you generously shared with everyone in that room. And I was so fortunate to be there, and I thank you so much. One of the things I have a question about about the sign language.
Oh, and yeah.
It's like so.
I can sign.
I feel like sign and it's like an art form.
It is.
It's almost like beautiful. I remember I spent a lot of time in the public schools working mm-hmm. with high school students. And there were a couple of instances where sign was part of mm-hmm. the conversation. And I thought if there was a way, because all the kids know every word to every song mm. that's, and they're singing it and they're rapping it in the hallways. And I thought, well, I wonder if there's a way that sign can be done sort of mm. in a rhythmic,
oh, yeah.
sort of like a rhythmic rap or something like that.
It is not my expertise, but sign language, when it's translating lyrics, is beautiful because it is almost taken its own shape mm-hmm. and its own story. And so there are quite a few interpreters, very famous interpreters. Wawa Stripe, I think is his last name. At the Super Bowl, for example, this was when Snoop Dogg was mm-hmm. On stage. More people were focused on Wawa than on Snoop Dogg because of the interpretation and because it has got so much movement and mm-hmm. flavor and authenticity to that translation. Mm-hmm. And so it is not like a traditional, hey, we're going to translate this from English to Spanish. It is its own form. It is mm-hmm. its own kind of, to your expression, kind of artwork.
Yeah.
And so that's how I view translations from songs. But the language itself also has specifically certain words, demographics, have so much intrinsic meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you like someone or you don't like someone, you can just tell by your facial expression, or you
right.
can just tell right. by the one of two signs that they use. There are words that are just consistently reinvented as well. One of my favorite ones that I learned was code switch. So mm-hmm. when you code switch, you know, if you're from a Latinx community and you enter kind of your workplace community, you're code switching, right? But deaf culture also right. has a word for it. I just learned inflation recently too, which I thought was a really funny one. But I think that is something that's so unique about the language, is it's consistently evolving. It's consistently focusing on a lot of other aspects within kind of your body to incorporate into what you're saying. Deaf people are very blunt. So if you've gained weight, they'll tell you right away.
Isn't that the truth? I had my cousin who would just be brutally honest. And I thought, oh my God, I just thought her personality was really, you know.
They don't have time. No. They don't have time for it.
Would be so shocking at times. And I was like, oh my God. She was like tough and like would say some really honey things in her sign. And I thought, oh my God, I don't know how she's getting away with it. But she did. She told it and it was clear. I remember I did a trip to India and Mother Teresa had this great facility methods of taking care of especially young women who'd been rejected by their families either for being blind or deaf and other disabilities. But those two, she and her team created these convents and they would set up knitting machines for training, and they would set up hand embroidery for the deaf. And so the knitting machines were easy to manipulate and they would be trained. And all of these girls were put in the convent so that they would be protected and not thrown out to the street, literally. And I was so excited because I was able to work with them and make these embroidered shirts and these beautifully hand-done woven pieces that were just spectacular. And at the same time, I was sort of supporting that ongoing thing. So it was benefiting me and my customer. And some of my favorite pieces that I will never get rid of are all of that handwork is so amazing. But that's an organized method that through bad, really bad situation there came together with a purpose. And are there situations here that reflect that?
I think in the Global South, so anywhere that it's not Europe or the United States or Canada or kind of anywhere north of the equator, disability, this was something that was told me a couple years ago when, you know, we talk about language being really important. Everybody has their own disability journey and has their own kind of adaptation of how disability is defined culturally, but also within the larger context of where you live. And so there are still places in the world where deafness is seen as a curse from God. You are deaf, therefore you are not worthy. You have a disability, therefore you should not belong to this family. And, you know, orphanages exist for that reason. There is a really interesting book based on a true story, not about deafness, but about epilepsy. It's called The River Catches When You Fall, or The River Catches As You Fall. And it's about a Hmong tribe where a boy has epilepsy, and that is seen as an act or a message from God. And so again, this kind of model of how we view and define disability in very different parts of the world still needs some of that work on evaluating, hey, how can we evangelize disability a bit more in today's context? And, you know, less of a Western context of disability is a really important part of a human experience. But what you had mentioned, you know, really resonated with me because I'd seen a very similar kind of aspect of deafness in Brazil. Being deaf in Brazil is actually pretty extraordinary because there are a lot of inclusionary barriers that exist. So there are safeguards for deaf students to go to school. The Brazilian alphabet is very similar to the American Sign Language alphabet. And so when I was living there in Sao Paulo, it was actually pretty easy to communicate just with the alphabet. But I had been in a Guarani tribe, which is the nomadic tribe between Uruguay, I believe Argentina, and Brazil, and had lived for a couple of weeks with this Guarani tribe. And they had an entire group of people who only spoke Guarani, which was, hey, we need to continue to keep this language. Mm-hmm. People that spoke Portuguese and Guarani who had their own kind of strife of, you should not speak Portuguese, you should not learn right. Portuguese, we need to keep our culture and our community close. And then they had a group of elders and young people and somewhat infants who were deaf, completely socially isolated. Not because, you know, it was seen as taboo or it was seen as something that was physically wrong with them, but they can't communicate. They can only communicate within their own group of people. Yeah. So they didn't even know Brazilian sign language. It was all home, what we call home sign. And so I think there's so much work to be done as we try to evangelize language, but also recognize in that context and with that lens of kind of a globalization that we have to recognize everybody has a different aspect and view of disability. But it doesn't make them lesser. It just means that there's more education to be done.
Yeah.
And you can look at that in kind of the private sector as well. Well, if that's the way in which disability is viewed in different parts of Brazil, the private sector really needs to start to also evaluate disability. I'd worked in Sao Paulo doing this in particular on a research project where there was a employment quota in which a certain number of people or an organization over 100 people had to employ a certain number of people with disabilities. But what does that mean? That means transportation actually needs to be accessible. Mm. That means you probably need to have a ramp in your building or certain outfits for accessibility. That means companies were, you know, essentially getting hit with that burden. And instead of doing that work, what was found within that report, a lot of companies would just send a check home. Hey, we don't want you to come to the office. We don't have to fix everything. Just take the check.
It's expensive. You know, it's an expensive retrofit to...
And sometimes. I don't think it's necessarily all the time. And it's certainly if you're a company of over 10 to 100,000 people, it's what we call as the disability tax. You know, this is an experience that somebody has every single day. If you have, I don't know, free pizza every day, you can certainly put Braille on your wall.
I think that... I think companies of all sizes want to participate if they can. I think it's more of a conversation of how.
Yep.
And it's still a new conversation. Mm-hmm. I think the accessibility to a space is really important. And if you want people to join you in some way, whether it's visiting or to be a part of the company. But there are different size companies. There are many companies in the fashion industry that are small and just trying to survive, but they would benefit greatly from talent that could, you know, on this level. So I think it takes some clever engineering. In the building I had before here, we had to come up with, you know, it was a building that had been around a long time. Nothing was fit for accessibility for disabilities. And we just came up with some imagination on how do we get people in? How do we, is the elevator, how do we set things up to make that work? And it takes some clever thinking and getting advice from, you know, the right way to do it. But I think the more people who are coming up with solutions can share solutions. So it's a numbers thing, right? Yep. How do you, somebody did it this way. Let's figure out how they did it. How can we adapt it here? And I think having these conversations and understanding what is disability? What's the range is right now, I think from COVID, the amount of mental stress on young women, and I've had doctors on podcasts talking about the physical damage being done for young women physically because of stress is just unbelievable. Yeah. It's like just you can't even imagine that something like that could happen. And at what point, because you have to make accommodations, you have to figure out what's happening, and you know, like, is it disability or is it something that's happening? So there's a lot of like interpretations of at what point. I think there's a general behavior that if somebody has an issue and they express it and they have some medical advice on how to deal with it, something you can deal with. But there are still categories that, like, what are the categories? How do people understand what they all are?
Yeah, so I just did a presentation on this morning. I personally view disability as a very broad stroke. So temporary disabilities, maybe I'm really stressed and maybe I have high anxiety, and that ebbs and flows, but certainly can be part of that community. And I think we have to cast a wider net, build a bigger tent when we talk about disability to include more people to feel welcome in that conversation. Permanent disability, something that you're living with every day, whether that's a chronic illness, which oftentimes you're not going to see, or somebody who, you know, had an accident and now uses a wheelchair or a mobility device. I think we also see disability as something that, again, is kind of in the realm of mental illness or within the realm of cognitive disability. And so that could look like things like schizophrenia or dementia or, you know, certainly mental illnesses that apply specifically to an older population. And again, like epilepsy, those are things that don't necessarily always exist within your experience, but happen later on. And so there are categories, certainly, but I think we have to broaden them and expand them so more people feel welcome and also take that identity with them.
Also asthma. I mean, I know I wouldn't put it under the category of disability, but we have somebody here who has incredibly difficult times at certain times of the year with asthma to the point where we're like, what are we going to, like, what are we doing? What are we going to do? Making sure that she has the right medication. She's an important part of the company and has been for a long time. And this just in the last couple of years. But it means we need to figure out how to help her. So I think it's sort of an interpretation of here's the situation. But the point I'm making is I don't know that we are all capable of identifying what's this is this kind of disability or not or whatever. But I do think when we're aware of the fact that we can make that person's life easier if we're aware of what we can do and we can do it. And that I think is the key in the workplace. For sure, because again, it's about people and their ability to be a part of the team and feel like they're contributing and functioning. And so whether it's they need to be off Monday and Friday to get the kids to doing or asthma or what or whatever level of it, I think those interpretations for now, and I think the more you and your work and people who are in the coordinates of that at different companies learn and can teach everyone what the new discovery. We've discovered this. We discovered that wheelchair can do this, or there's a new wheelchair that does this, this, and this. And so I think it's a constant communication, right? And and the storytelling.
And I think the biggest piece of this, if it's the main takeaway, is the data. We do not have enough data on kind of the economic output or the economic benefit, not because, you know, that's all that people are good for, but because when we are trying to convince companies and organizations to invest in this space and to invest in entrepreneurs with disabilities or invest in adaptive technology or assistive technology, invest in adaptive fashion, the use case and the business case for it is severely lacking. And I have a colleague and friend who calls it the disability data deficit, DDD, which is also my my full name, Danielle Dorothy Decker. But it is a problem within the community, specifically within the business community or those that are investing in this space, to say that there isn't real hard evident data around the economic potential.
Yeah. I think that would be great for you. I think the more information that can prove that participant is really a key part of the success of a company. And from a business, you know, I have two hats. I'm a designer and a creative person for my company, but I'm also the business person. I never thought I could be. But I have to look at, we have to earn a certain amount of money as a company so that everybody can get paid, everybody can get bonuses, everybody can get increases. Mm-hmm. The group makes that happen. And so there is an importance in having that data so that you prove, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit you just heard talking. She could probably knock out a big business. She could probably get it right going in a very productive way with her just intense desire to do it, her ability to communicate it. And so I think that now, who would do that? Who would?
I've got a list.
I mean, I think that's...
Yeah. No, I think just like any project, right? First comes the funding. Second comes the data collection itself, making sure that we're extending to places beyond just the U.S. and Europe, but to the global south, and looking at opportunities to make real investments there so that we're not going on this journey in a separate direction, that we're pulling along others with us. You know, the data piece, I am also kind of certain that it needs to come with the community, built for the community and with the community, meaning the people that are scraping for the data and those that are building the context around some of these important narratives or stories or doing interviews with people with disabilities or also disabled themselves. I think that's a critical piece to this. Again, back to storytelling, ensuring that those are authentic stories told by the community from the community. And so... You know, that is on my bucket list of things to do in 2024, as to building real momentum. The data that exists today, done by certain big four companies, isn't really great and accurate and hard and true. So we need to be able to get to a place where the pendulum swings the other way. And so that companies really see, oh, this is intrinsic value to my company, to my employee base, to the investment in my products, and ultimately the innovation that'll change the consumer mindset. And so we need to invest there to be able to have a trickle-down effect. Yeah.
And like you said, it's the opportunities are really broad. It's disability, the aging population. There are different things that are happening that kind of broaden that and make it a much bigger, you know, opportunity. So dare I ask what the government is doing
Well, the city of New York's pretty good, actually.
That's good.
And I'm just going to speak for New York. I think we have a long way to go when it comes to getting the private sector and the public sector to talk, because that doesn't happen in a lot of different spaces. But I'd say that, well, I'll shout him out, Victor Calice, who is the commissioner on for New York City for people with disabilities, has done a lot of work in making sure that New York City is accessible from the parks to subways to ferries to trains, planes, cars. I think there's certainly still a lot of work to be done for the city when we talk about employment in particular, equal accommodations, accessibility of transport. Mm-hmm. The MTA is going through a bit of a moment right now. Yes. When it comes to that, NYU Tandon School, there's something called the Ability Project, which is looking at ensuring that blind people have access to transportation. There's a lot of really interesting work going on in New York City. I kind of consider it somewhat of a petri dish of what the rest of the world can
learn.
Awesome.
That's great.
And I think it is a fascinating city to be able to reach and target different audiences to ensure, again, we're building with a collective, not just with certain consumers.
Wow. I'm thrilled to hear that. That is really fantastic.
Right in our backyard.
it's so great. I mean, the city is a great place. And I no matter what each city is going through now, New York City is just an extraordinary mm-hmm. place. And like you said, if you want to be where it's really happening, you better be in New York to make that all happen. And it's great to hear that exists. I love the word Abilities Project.
Ability Project.
That is so great.
They're doing a lot of really important work, again, from the technical aspects, like so looking at engineering, looking at technology, how to include it and incorporate it into different tech that exists today or new tech for the future. Regine Gilbert, who's there, is doing a lot of really important work as a professor. There are certainly ways in which, again, the public and private sector can partner mm-hmm. to find better routes forward. There's an artist I love who you saw who was in my hallway,
amazing.
Frank the Ape, and one of his big mottos is better together. So I think that is maybe a really great culmination mm-hmm. factor that mm-hmm. we can get there together in a much better way mm-hmm. if we just put our thinking caps on and we're in the same room.
I think that's a universal, that those two words are universally good for mm. everyone. And Ability Project is so powerful. Mm. I love that phrase. I think it's amazing. I think you can design the evening mm. we can invite the government.
Commissioner Curry.
I think it's a good idea. I think we should just put it all together. And so basically we're inviting all of you who are listening to this podcast.
Tea really quick.
Go
sorry.
Ahead. So we're going to invite everybody to join us. We're going to come up with some ideas on how you can do it. And we will obviously film all of this and make it available. I think this will be a sharing experience for you, and you're going to want to share it with people you know and love. And especially for those of you in the fashion industry, I think this is going to be extraordinarily inspiring. And I'm very excited to talk more about it with my peers and see the potential of where we can go with this. And you have definitely educated me on the continued belief that what my initial impression was of this positive power with humor and joy, that it does, it's true, it's there. It's just, it's a potent part mm-hmm. of that world of anything is possible no matter what.
We need more benefactors like yourself who are willing and open to learning more. I think that's part of this conversation, yeah. which is the ignorance. Oh, I don't know about it. I don't need to know about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think the normal word is curious and stay curious, continue to ask questions, even if they're the hard questions.
Yeah.
I think today we don't do enough of that. But being able to cultivate and generate experiences where people feel compelled to share, compelled to stay curious, is a really important part of how we continue conversations that have an impact and that ultimately we can ladder up to government, or we can ladder up to the private sector, or we can ladder up to fashion industry leaders and executives and say, this is the change we want to see.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Norma.
More to follow. I'm looking forward to it. Yep. May 2nd. Thank you so much.
Thank you.